I am delighted to welcome Chiki Sarkar to Network Capital. She's built her category of one at the intersection of media, publishing, venture capital, and so many things. We're going to talk more about it. But generally, I know Chiki because I met her very briefly at a Delhi Public School reunion many years back. At that time, I was working at Microsoft. I think she was just thinking about setting up Juggernaut, or maybe she had set up Juggernaut. And now, 9 years hence, it's become one of India's leading publishers. Thank you so much for taking time out, Chiki. I always begin by asking, you have multiple identities. How do you like to describe yourself?
It's very simple. I call myself a publisher. I
You
make
call it.
books. And so
And
that's what
you.
I mean. I haven't, of course, I like everyone else. I'm a wife and a mother and a daughter and all of that, but essentially I'm a publisher.
And did you always know you wanted to be a publisher?
So, I'm the girl who, if you went back to my school and you asked my classmates, like, are you surprised that she's a publisher? Everyone would say no. I was massive obsessive bookworm, really all through my childhood. And I was always very good at the humanities. I was a good student, but very much an artsy humanities kind of good rather than sort of physics, science, math type of good. So I think I always knew I was going to be around the world of words and stories in some form. So, I come from a journalist background. It may have been as a journalist, it could have been potentially in media in some other form. For example, I may could have potentially worked as a copywriter. So I come from a journalist background. I read a lot, so I always knew I was going to be around sort of reading, writing, words, language, storytelling, all of that. And so when I ran the school paper, so I was always very interested in journalism. And I had a radio show at college. So I was always kind of more in the media side of things. And then when I finished university, I applied for a couple of jobs and I applied to publishing, I applied to newspapers. And the only person who gave me a job was a publishing company. And then I loved it. The minute I stepped in, I thought I found my calling. Unfortunately for I'm not a great example of someone who can give a young person advice about finding their calling because I've had a very straight, you could even say a boring trajectory. I was the bookworm. I was always in a certain, I intern, the things I did extracurricular were like books and all of that. And then I went and got this one job. And also one of the things in my life is that I never got a ton of jobs. Like I never got into a ton of good universities. I only got into one really good university. And then when I applied to like lots of fancy jobs, I got turned down from everyone, but I got one good job. So I've always said there's always been one person who's accepted me, and then I've got rejections, like always in my life. And so this one publishing company called Bloomsbury offered me a job. I was finishing up college and I started work 5 days after I finished my finals in college. So I really never had a break. I just never had a gap year. I never took time out from college. I just went from college straight into work. And actually, my college career wasn't especially remarkable in any form. I was, but the minute I got to work, I thought, wow, I found it. I'm not meant to be an academic. I'm not meant to be a scholar. This is my life. I love it. And so that. And then I stayed within publishing. I've sort of moved on and moved up and done things. Particular things at different stages in my career, but really it's always been publishing.
Then you move back to India. Why?
Very simple. I was 28 and I was asked to be the editor-in-chief of Random House India, which was being set up. And I wasn't going to get a job that fancy in London for a long time. I just thought I better go and, when you have an opportunity, you should go and jump, is my view. Once you're quite clear, it's a good opportunity, it's important, and it's thing to do, you must jump. You must not overthink it. You must not feel nervous. Of course, if you're going to feel nervous, you will. But I knew it was the right thing for me, and I just did it. And so
And
that's
then
how I came.
you came to India in this fancy job and you did really well. You commissioned some iconic books. I think in the industry, most people would know you. And then in 2015, you decided to start your own company. What was the problem that you were trying to solve with Juggernaut?
So after Random House, by the way, I moved to Penguin India, which was then the country's biggest publisher, and I spent about 5 or 6, 7 years. And why it's sort of worth talking about is Random House was like a startup. Remember that I was its founding editor-in-chief. It was, I mean, of course, Random House was backed by being, it was the largest publishing house in the world, but the India outpost was tiny and had just set up. And so it was scrappy, you know, it was, and I was scrappy. I was 28. What did I know about anything? And what the Penguin period taught me was scale, because Penguin India remains and is an outstanding publishing company. And it was the largest publishing company at the time, and still remains so. And so what I learned in Penguin India was scale, and I learned ambition. So what does that mean when in the world of books? In the world of books, it might mean that you're, as a young Random House person, I was kind of taking chances on young people who did quite well. But learning to be ambitious and going and getting a really big author, a really famous name, saying that, look, we're, it's 10,000 copies isn't good enough. Let's try and sell 100,000 copies. Mm. That was sort of what happened. And then what happened at the end of Penguin is I'd had a sort of almost the best year of my career. This was 2014. You know, I published a book called Accidental Prime Minister, which many people think, you know, Prime Minister Modi used it. It was one of the things he used as part of his campaign in that year. And it sold about 100,000 copies, became one of the highest selling sort of biggest books. And I thought, so I always thought, like, look, if I lived in America and, you know, imagine if I got Biden's right-hand person to do a tell-all about what it's like and how he snores in bed and how his dogs are always biting it, whatever it is that you want, you know.
Yeah.
And it, how many copies would it sell? It would sell 1 million copies, right? And I thought, wow, like, look at our numbers. And by the way, it's still, that market hasn't grown. I mean, we can talk about that later, but I thought 100,000 is at the top, right? I'm like, is that it? Is that as good as it can get?
For a country with 1 billion people.
Yes. Well, of course, it's, then we are, you know, how many people speak English? How many people have the income to buy books? Blah, blah, blah. Of course, there's all that. You can splice it anyway, which way, but still it's a good number, but it's a small number too, right? It's not a number that you might be excited if you worked in Microsoft. I mean, it's like a big number. And so it was sort of asking that question, wanting to do things in a new way. There'd been a merger in the meantime. And as you know, in mergers, it's never necessarily a comfortable time for old employees and so forth. So it was a combination of sort of the tensions of the merger and my own restlessness. And I said, I'm going to go out and do it. This is the time. I feel good. I feel confident. I'd had sort of 10 years of real, you know, experience in my life. And so, yeah.
So the problem statement was one of scale and also experimenting with formats, experimenting with different kind of writers, because you've had the knack of picking like really serious books and also, you know, sort of massy books, then experimenting with this. So talk us through the problem statement, because I'm about to ask you about the parallels between venture capital and publishing.
Problem statement was, can I do things better than the existing core? Which is, can I sell more books? Can I get more people?
That's it. Not can you play the game of scale? Books. Absolutely. Yeah.
Not enough people read books. Not enough people buy books in English language in India. Can I change things? So that was the problem scale. Why books are like venture capital, and it's not just me, but it's virtually. So a publisher like a person in the movies or a person in the music is always constantly making bets, and 95% of these bets don't work. It's sort of like you, and then 5% work. So for every Uncle Wariku's do epic shit, I have just today, this morning, I had to do an exercise called a pulping exercise, where the warehouse sends you lists of books that haven't moved, right? And it's often very depressing reading, because you'll say, oh, wow, there's like 3,000 copies and 25 copies returned last year, and there were no sales. You know, there was just, and so then, you know, your warehouse says, look, should we pulp some of this stuff? We don't need it. But what this exercise teaches you is your failures. What didn't work, right? Because they're not selling. I mean, ultimately, there are two or three ways you can judge the success of a book. One is if the if the world thinks it's a good, or the critical community or whatever, it's perceived as a very good book, a serious book. And there are, you know, a handful of books in our lives where like it's of such a high quality that it like it, the sales sort of don't matter. It's an outstanding book. It should be published. And then, of course, a more conventional way to judge success is sales. And what every publisher will tell you, and every publisher will tell you historically, is that we make bets every single day and most of them fail. And so, which is why one of the things you see with the world of publishing is that it's one of the big qualitative differences. I often find quality differences in the way people approach, are the way they appear. You can't have, you know how like, I often find like in the world of business, it's a lot of direct gung-ho-ness. We're going to hit that. We're going to make our targets, blah, 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 blah. Publisher rarely speaks that language because we're losers. And in some ways, every one of us has, and you know, these books that don't work, we've loved as much as the books that do. And often it's unfathomable why certain books work. I mean, you know, there's a reason why when Chetan Bhagat was first selling his books and sending it to publishers, then no. It's not because people were snobby. Penguin India historically has published Shobha De, like lots of fun commercial books. So there's no reason for it to say no to Chetan Bhagat. Mm. It's just that Chetan Bhagat's book was a nice book of its kind. There were many books like that, many kinds of writers like that. And Chetan's clicked, right? Good for him. And he's already grown as a writer, and you know, he's a fantastic icon now. But when you sort of, if he was this guy in his 20s coming to all the publishing houses, it wasn't a snobbery that why people were turning him down. It was just simply because, you know, like there was, it's very hard. You, it's hard to judge. It's hard to decide. I mean, unless there's quality that blares out, it's very, very difficult to tell what will work in India. And so what that means is, so two things, what I'm trying to say is that anyway, most of your books are going to not work. And then of the books that work, hand on heart, how many did you really think were going to work? Super honest, right? Like, I can't tell. There are some books I know will work. You know, I did a book on UPSC by a woman who was All India 3 on UPSC. I'm like, yeah, it's going to work. I did Rajat Gupta's memoirs. I knew it was going to work. You're not going to know it, like all of that. But did I know Dubai Epic Shit was going to sell 300,000 copies in year one? No way. No way. I mean, Ankur didn't, I didn't.
It's a fairly popular book, but yes, it's hard to predict. I mean, the guy is fairly popular.
Yes, but not only do most of our books not work, but I would say at least 50% of my books that do work, I wouldn't be able to say to you that they worked at the level they did. And I think that and that's what I think makes us like VCs, because I think, like, to my understanding, ultimately VCs are about taking bets. Of course, you can play it safe and you can say there's a market and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the cleaning market is going to grow. And so we should have something in fintech or this or that, cleaning products or whatever it is you want to say. But you don't. And there are tons, which is why tons of those unicorns fail. You thought they were going to work, but they don't. There'll be odd companies that will rise up. VCs also, I know, you know, just sort of 5% of their companies work and go through an IPO, and then that's where the money comes through. And, you know, before, until then, it doesn't. They're handing out the checks and everyone's waiting for payday. And publishing, and I think the work, publishing is absolutely built like that. And historically, if you read stories of sort of iconic publishers across the world, they're people who were mavericks. They were people who were gamblers. They were people who were risk takers, because it's what you did. You went up and said, okay, let's take a chance on this and let's take a chance on that. And let's see if I can get the money together and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's a kind of, it was, I mean, now with consolidation of companies and we have the very large publishing conglomerates, that kind of culture probably exists less. But at the heart of publishing, and certainly for any independent company like mine, entrepreneurialism, risk-taking, chance-making are at the center of what we do, just like you. Yeah.
And there are some other similarities as well, like the process of finding the best entrepreneurs or encouraging the best writers to you know, work with you and not go to another VC or in this case, a publishing house. You've had to do a lot of that at Juggernaut because it's a new publishing house. People knew you, but maybe didn't know the company that you were setting up. How did you go about building that foundation? And how do mature writers approach you, or how do you approach them? And how do you encourage younger writers to do the same?
So I think the first, which is again connected to some of these ideas we're talking, is hustle. You gotta hustle, like hustle the whole time. I'm a real believer in the cocktail, the dinner party, the cocktail party to make contacts and get books. So I you know, my husband just finds it really annoying because I rarely go into a party just thinking I'm going to relax and enjoy. I always go and say, oh, who am I going to meet today? And then if I get either meet one person who could write a book for me or they give me an idea. Often it's a conversation and they'll say something. I'll go, oh, wow, really? I didn't know this, right? And I'll go, I'll turn this into a book. Or I'll invite X and Y to come and meet me or whatever it is, right? I think constant hustling, going out, meeting people, and you have to convince them. The other thing is, we said, what is it that Juggernaut could do in particular, right? So there were two things that I could do really, really well. One is we have an outstandingly high quality, intelligent team. My editors are like off a quality that's like very superior. So like, I have to say, like, our editorial meeting once a week is like some of my most favorite times of the week. It's just so, it's just the range of people, the range of their conversations, what they talk about, what their interests are. It's kind of really, so one is, I think we always talk. And one of the things we do is we don't wait for the book to come to us. We go and make the book. So we'll say, for example, like, let me give you an idea of a book that I've been obsessed about and I've never found a writer for. So if anyone sees this and thinks they have this book, they can write it. I want to do a commission, a history of India, but told from South India. So I always like, when as kids, when we study Indian history, it's always from the north, right? The Aryans came.
Yeah.
And then the Mughals or the Sultanate or the British or whatever, right? And but what if I turned the country around and I told history from down south? But to return to sort of what was Juggernaut's special sauce, right? So one is we sort of made books in-house. So we talked about, we said, you know what, we really need this book or that book. Like, one of the things, for returning to this history of South India, one of the things we noticed is that, you know, I mean, this everyone knows in the world of anyone who's doing business, that South India is, of course, far more affluent and middle class in North India. And so, you know, virtually most sort of relatively high-end products in India are sold more in the South than in the North. 60% of sales, even from an FMCG. I remember we had an author who was at Unilever who said that Unilever, like 60% of their sales were from the South and 40 in the North. And that holds for books. And in fact, Bangalore today is the second highest selling book city that purchases books. So we said, gosh, our readers are in the South and we're making books from the North because we all sit in Delhi.
Yeah.
And how can we turn this around? Or we'll say, who are the five political stars that we have to get writing for us? Or we'll say, you know, like, talking about babies. So I'm an obsessive sleep training person. And we have our editor-in-chief, Path, who's just 3 years ago had kids, and we both read a book by this very anal sleep training woman called Gina Ford. She's a best-selling sleep trainer, a baby nurse in England, and it's the best baby training book in UK. And we said we really need one for India, but it has to work for Indian parents, because Indian parents are not great at scheduling for their children. They'll keep the children up late, relaxed. The kid will be taken to the hotel while they're all eating dinner. No one says, oh, 7 p.m. time for bed, you know. But within that, of course, parents do go crazy without sleep. And especially if you have working moms and working dads, how do they manage? So one of the things a book that we've been wanting to do and we feel like there's a market for is a Indian sleep trainer, but someone who speaks the language of Indian couples. So not like a very Western way, because that person has to understand what Indian behaviors are like. And Indians are not going to be that regimented. So within that, so, you know, bottom line, juggernaut is constantly asking ideas, like, and thinking about it in a kind of big trends way. What do we think is happening on history? What do we think that's happening on politics? In the social media influencer world, what are the books we need? And then we think of the book idea and we go and find the writer. 90% of juggernaut's list comes like that. We often pitch people through Twitter. I mean, two of my I think juggernaut's, I arguably our most successful book of our list is a book called Early Indians by a man called Tony Dixon. I just messaged him on Twitter saying, hey, would you like to write a book for me? Because for some reason his articles were constantly showing up for me on my feed, and and he writes about prehistoric India, early Indians. I liked it, and I said, "Will you write this book?" And he said, "Yeah, sure." So we, you know, I just wrote to a website that I follow on Twitter, and I met direct messaged them just yesterday saying, "Listen, I love the content you're putting out. I think it's a book." So. Yeah. We're constantly going out there, and we do not wait for an agent. We do not wait for an author. We go out and make our books. And so because often our pitches are very strong, people say yes. So, you know, we are just about to publish a book by Milan Soman, whose memoirs were published by Penguin, and he was very happy there. But one of my editors had this great idea. You know, do you remember his mother became really viral doing push-ups in her sari? And she said, you know, why don't we do a fitness book with Milind and his mom? I thought this was genius. So I reached out to him and I said, look, would you like to do it? And he said, I love this idea, but I also want my wife involved, and let's do it with fitness across every age. My wife is like in her 30s. I'm in my 50s. Mom's in her 70s or 80s. We're like done. Book. We're publishing in June. So, you know, I would, if I just gone to Milind Soman and said, oh, you know, Mr. Soman, would you write me a book? I think that, but he liked this idea because he's, you know, he loved the idea of sort of involving his mother and doing this book. So it's about, you know, Kareena Kapoor, again, we don't just go to, particularly one of the things that Juggernaut's done is gone out and got celebrity, and we find the exact thing that we think that they really stand for. So with Kareena Kapoor, I didn't say write your memoirs. I thought, look, she's not going to say yes. She's still in the middle of her career. But I said, look, you're very public with your children. You're always taking, you know, there are photographs of your pregnancy, and you're doing shoots in your pregnancy, and you take your kids along. And Temu was a media sensation. I said, write me the pregnancy book, you know, the pregnancy Bible. And she loved the idea. And again, it was the right pitch to the right person at the right time, right? And I think our other special sauce really is marketing. So in my afterlife, I think one of the great things about the world of work is that you start out in one field, and then hopefully if you're lucky, you find another thing you're surprisingly good at that takes you by surprise. And you may not have ever said it 20 years ago, but it happens that I love marketing. I'm just genuinely interested in marketing and publicity. I just love it. And because of my interest in it, we do very, very good marketing. We just pay attention to every book. And my editors are involved in conceptualizing some of the marketing ideas because they have content intelligence. So our publicists don't have that content intelligence. So they don't know the smart piece that our writers can write. But our editors do, right? Because they've really read the book, or they don't know the exact extracts to pitch. Because they're, you know, and our view is that the media have a ton on their plate. They, you know, everyone is understaffed. So if you can do a half the work for them, which is you give the great pitch, you find the great extract, you do it all and you give it to them and they go, yeah, great, this is great. I didn't have to think about it. Then it really works. So we've sort of have a kind of total approach to publicity in the way we think about it, how we conceptual, like I'll give you another really, like it's a very juggernaut rule. So once we publish a book, when we talk about it to our sales team, when we talk about it to our marketing team, guess what? We never ever say the book is good. Because my sales team, okay, which is HarperCollins' sales team. Now HarperCollins is a large multinational company. That sales team is selling thousands and thousands of new books every day. And what is it that every editor tells them? Fantastic book. It's a great book. right? And now the sales guy is fried. Firstly, he knows that the numbers in publishing means 90% of those books are going to flop. So whether the editor loves it or not, it doesn't matter. This is not necessarily going to work. So he knows it. So he's jaded, right? Because he's dealt with failures far more than success. And he's also, that's all he's heard. That's all that the person in the newspaper or the magazine or the TV station hears, right? How do you talk about a book without saying it's good? And that's been like, so, that's where I've loved these few years, because it's only when I started Jackanaut that I feel like I've just become a better professional. Like I can articulate what makes like ways of us doing marketing, or the ways of us finding the right books, or the ways of us editing in these very, very clear ways, which I wouldn't have before. Because I mean, you know, once you set up your own business and, you know, you have to make money to survive, you're really forced to be sort of the best version of yourself. And that's sort of been the great joy of being, you know, setting up on my own.
And you've done a phenomenal job. Do you plan to be India only or India first, or do you plan to have other offices in time? It's a big market. So what's your approach?
I want to grow. I think India itself is just, I have to grow far more in India before I even think of the world. And, you know, the other thing is, I think Netflix sometimes discovers this, is that this idea that you create like content and then it goes everywhere. And of course, The Crown or whatever it is, the few, you know, Bridgerton or whatever, This Is Us or whatever that's, you know, there'll be a couple of things that will do really well globally. But they discovered in India, for example, that Indians require Indian content, right? Which is for them absolutely, you know, Prime got it bit more right than Netflix.
Yeah.
Again, depending on the conversations, we have a lot in-house in our company and looking at these sort of TV companies and looking at what we can derive from them as lessons. And so I think the thing about content is that at least, I mean, there will be those hits that work everywhere, 50 Shades of Grey, blah, blah, blah. But every country has its own readership. It has its own approach. I mean, you take Gina Ford, this British who does the sleep training books that I love so much. Now, an American wouldn't read Gina Ford. But Gina Ford's British. She goes on British TV. British, famous British celebrities use her and abuse her. And so she's a name in Britain. And so there's a kind of cultural thing in it, you know. So I think that some things can move different countries, but really, and so when you look at sort of global multinational companies, each of their regional divisions are very almost in a silo. So they will talk and they'll collaborate, and the big books they'll buy all together.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But that's just sort of absolutely at the top of their list, right? And then the large amount of their list are books for that world, for their market. Germans read very different books from, I mean, I remember when I worked in London, I worked for the company that published Harry Potter. And I learned a very cool fact, which was, so, you know, Harry Potter, because there was such a craze about it. So what would happen is the English edition would come out. And then it took a while for people to translate the text. And then all the Germans and Europeans were going crazy, right? They were waiting for this book to be translated. In the meantime, Bloomsbury would send out their English edition to these markets for whoever wants to read it. And the market that was really big on English books is the Dutch market. They're very big English speakers. So it was kind of, you know, it's so particular, right? I mean, these kind of, that every region has its own history, and that's its own way of reading or whatever it is, or what they like, or languages they read, that's so to return to it, if Jackanaut ever went global, it would literally mean different Jackanauts.
Yeah.
Ownership, but there wouldn't be a ton of connection on that.
Another parallel with venture capital, when they set up their different offices, they tend to at least now give them a very localized flavor. Like Sequoia India is now called something else. It works very differently. So does Sequoia China. Would be true for many others as well. I'm just surprised to learn so many parallels in the differences and similarities in both industries. So thank you for spelling it out.
Yeah.
So Chiki, tell me about your product evolution. I've been following Jackanaut for several years now. My first book was by Sage. I think they reached out to me, similar to you. And second one, when Sage shut down, Penguin published my other one. I've had wonderful experiences with both publishers. But I always thought, as an industry, publishing makes it really hard for any new writer to find them and pitch them. And I thought Juggernaut wanted to change that. But you've built all of that. How have you thought about the product?
I have to say that that part is more a dream than a reality, if I'm really honest. Largely because of this. So, okay. One is that publishing become more democratic and more open? By the way, publishing is. As in, look at the range of writers who write for publishing. There will be an Ankur Warik on one end, there'll be an Abhijit Banerjee, a Nobel Prize winner, on the other side. There'll be a business writer on one side. There'll be a health person on the other side. So very, very different types of writing. They're very different writers who come from very different worlds. So what do they all have? And are they all like super networked with publishers? No. I mean, they're really not, right? I mean, I work with Ruchita Devekar, the dietitian. She didn't know about anything about publishing when I approached her. So, but here's what happens, right? Most of Indian publishing and most of global publishing is nonfiction based, right? And the nonfiction that we think of are really of many different kinds, right? So they are not just sort of self-help or history or things like that, but they're also just like domain specializations. It could be finance investment. It could be cookery. It could be PCOS disorder. It could be dealing with depression. It could be decorating your house. It could be gardening, right? So when you think of the bulk of any publisher's list, 50, 60%, I would say, would be nonfiction of various kinds, right? Now, imagine you're an unknown writer, right? You're a person who wants to write a book and you feel like I'll never be able to break it into publishing. So first, let me tell you that most, particularly in India, there is a quite scrappy entrepreneurial, we're looking for someone constantly trying energy across all publishing houses. I mean, Juggernaut has it in excess, but we have it in all, I really would say that virtually all publishers have it, right? So now let's ask, what are you writing, right? So if you are writing, most people who say they want to write tend to be fiction writers. They don't have to be nonfiction writers. So, you know, we're always looking for domain experts. I mean, it would be great to get a great Indian gardening book or, you know, a book on how to design for small Indian homes or whatever it is.
Right.
So your main thing has to be about domain expertise, and you have to show and demonstrate to me that you are one of the best people and most qualified to write this. That is all we pick. Okay, that is our one criteria.
Competence, yes, that's one.
Competence, yeah. And reputation in your own world. So, for example, this archaeologist is not a glamorous person. I think she's quite an old lady or something. I don't actually know a thing about her, but I know that she's well, very, very well reputed. And she's like, I've never written. And we said, we want it. We'll hold your hands. So we, you know, so that's how we approach the world of nonfiction, right? And then, of course, there's a component which is celebrity, but I'm presuming you're not a famous person. You just want to write, right? The second category, which is most of you, is that you want to write novels. And those are, when people say I want to write, they almost certainly want to write fiction, right? And how do you get it? So one, 300% is harder. Why is it harder? Most Indian publishers are trying to shorten the fiction. And Juggernaut, by the way, is primarily a nonfiction house because Indians buy nonfiction rather than fiction. And so this is what we focused on building. But most other companies are also like, they're really shortening their fiction list for the same reason as we have, right? So now, so automatically that gateway is small. And what an editor, and this gateway by the way, it isn't that the person has to know someone or anything like that, because actually all companies have submissions emails to send.
And they're actually read.
They are read. But here's what happens, right? I'm going to be super honest, 90% of the, I mean, I spent a large part of my career reading those submissions, both as an early young editor in England, which is one of the first jobs you were given. You read the slush files. I actually wrote to some of these people, had correspondence with them. And then when I set up Juggernaut, and in my early days of Randomize, I've had periods where I've really read all the submissions that came to me. And any other publisher will tell you that 95% of them are not great. They're just not. They don't cut it, right? I mean, they're written with the best of intentions, and someone's written it and they put their heart and soul in it, but they're not that great. So what that means is that so that's one piece. Park that, right? Because if you're an unknown writer, that's not what you put your heart and soul in it. You think this book is good, and you're feeling frustrated that this book is not being taken on, right? Mm. But the couple of points I want to make is the reason your book is not being taken on the whole. Of course, you can find me a million examples on the other side, but I'm going to on the whole, right? One is, no one will ever say this because, of course, they can't. It's not politically correct to say it. They didn't like it. But you don't want to say that to the person. If someone sends me a book, I can't say I didn't like it. I just really can't. I think it's really rude. And somebody's put their heart in. So what do publishers do? Since they don't have the time to write that one, remember the kind of submissions people are getting. They don't have the time to write very detailed letter to every single person who comes, right?
Of course.
So they didn't like the book and they don't have that time. So what they do is they write a very polite, generic, thank you so much. This is sadly not for us. Now, why do we do that? Just to evade trouble. Because we know that we don't have the bandwidth to give you all that attention, right? And at the same time, we don't want to be rude and offend you. And what's the point of offending you without giving you really constructive feedback, right? And we know we can't always give it because of just the traffic and volume that we get. And so we say no. So hard as it is to accept, if someone has said no, do you know what excuses they're saying? They'll have write a version of the kind of letter I have. It means somewhere they didn't like it. Now, but I want to just say to you that, is it possible for anyone? You're sitting in some small town, you've written the book. Can someone in a publishing house read it? Yes. Those means absolutely exist. They exist in people's websites. You can send it out and it will be read, but it may not be read in a month. It might be read in 4 months. It might be read in 5 months, okay? Because you're in a traffic line, a queue, and the young editors who are the most, by the way, the best people to read your book because they're enthusiastic and they're longing to find the next new thing, okay? They're the ones who are going to read your book, and if they've said passed on it, it's because they don't like it, and they're not going to tell you that, and they're not going to tell you that because they don't have the bandwidth to tell you that properly, right? And it's about being nice, it's about being courteous, it's about keeping that conversation short. Unfortunately, call it better or worse, but that is what it is, right? But is it possible for you to submit? Oh yes. Acceptance harder. Why is it harder? Because look, the difference between publishing and say posting on Medium or anything, what's the kind of big difference between tech and sort of call it the legacy businesses? Someone has an eye, someone is curating you. Someone says, I like this, I don't like this. I'm going to take a chance on this, I'm not going to take a chance on this, right? Now, if you're in the tech business, you are basically arguing that that person is very subjective, and that subjectivity means many things fall through the net, and it's not a fair subjectivity, right? And so I'm going to make it totally open for everything. I get it, it's one argument, right? But take a VC, take publishing, take the movies. In the end, it's often that the single judgment is not invalid because it's not like, it means that everyone doesn't get to publish, right? The single judgment is saying that these are the things I would take a bet on. And why are they making that judgment? Because they like, why am I qualified to do this? Because reading is all I did. I mean, I was like this dork who was terrible at everything except reading books. And it's what I did from the age of five. I read and read and read and read and read and read and read. And when I feel sad, I don't watch a TV show and binge on it. I read. And every night, or most nights, when I'm not tired with the baby, I will, you know, read a book to bed. And in my mind, I think, what's the next book I'm reading? And what does constant reading do to you? It creates a kind of muscle in your brain, which gives you a sense of what's good, what's not, what works, what doesn't, what, and more importantly, what you like and why you like it. And that judgment across the world, right? The human judgment, which comes out of experience and hard work and training, cannot just be thrown away because of, I think both those things can exist.
Yeah.
But it's that, I mean, again, to give you a very simple example, you know, there was a business called Wattpad, which started in Toronto, right? Which is, it was like everybody could write, everybody could upload. Mm. Now, why hasn't Wattpad created more hits? Like, what is it, right? And it's that in the end, a book does well, but then it's, and even in the Wattpad system, right? It's one person, it'll be like one person says, I really like this book. And then they make 10 other people read it. And then those 10 people say, I really like it. It is the individual judgment. But in the end, the thing about publishing is that the individual judgment, whether it's on a thriller or a horror story or like a very serious work of politics or a very serious novel written in Tamil, you know, it's somebody saying, I'm reading all the time. Every day I read, like this week I've read 2 to 3 manuscripts, 2 to 3 full books. Like yesterday I read one, last night before going to sleep till midnight. And I'm reading all the time. I'm reading constantly because I need to find books in my list and I need to make hits. I'm hungry for it, by the way. So we're all on the same team. I mean, I'm not saying, oh, I have my 300 authors and I'm only going to work for them. I'm like, no, fuck, man. I have to grow the list. I have to find the next hit. I have to find the next talent. If I don't find the next talent, I'm going nowhere. So that hunger exists, but and we're reading it. And then I said, this is the book I want. This is the book. You know, I remember we got a book that was sent to us about 4 years ago called Bottle of Lies, which is about Rand Baxy. Really brilliant. The nonfiction book, one of our biggest successes. And I remember I read it on a Friday night and I wrote to the agent the next day and I said, I have to buy it. I'm going to buy it. I love this book. It took me like, you know, a night of reading. You know what you know. You know what your gut likes. You know what your stomach likes. You know what your years of reading has told you is a good book. And then you go out and go and get it, right? Now, this active choice and decision-making that goes into publishing, it's very powerful. I actually think that the making everything available is great and it puts a certain amount up on the surface, but I think that there is also very much, and I don't want to say that ours is the only way. I think the idea of the democratic platform is truly a fantastic thing. But for any company, I mean, it's also like a VC. I mean, he's saying, I made that choice, right? And with every choice that you make, there are 10 things you choose not to do.
More than that, yeah.
And some of them turn out to be hits, right? I mean, like, for example, my most famous turn down was White Tiger. I didn't love it. I'm really happy it did well. It's, you know, I'm happy for him. I'm happy for his publisher. I'm happy for India that it won the Booker. It's great. But I didn't love it. I didn't, right? And I'm not going to regret that. And because because the thing about it is that my bets have worked. And then I have bets that don't work. But I'm not sure that turning it into a larger, the democratic tech space isn't the place where we actually end up making. It's not that process is creating more hits. You know,
I'm not sure. I will I could not agree more.
You know,
what some people would say there is that more than it being democratic, the fact that it's not clear what does a publishing process look like is the problem. But now you've spelled out through this podcast very clearly that these manuscripts are read and somebody is actually sitting on the other side of the table and is probably just not happy with what he or she is reading. So you can try again.
I'll tell you what happens often, right? We'll be reading a lot of books, manuscripts, eyes get a little bleary, a bit bored, tired, low energy. And then one day we'll get a manuscript and the first, there'll be something, at least for me, I know, like there'll be something in that first page and I'm like, oh fuck, I just woke up. And then you want to turn the next page.
Yeah. Instinct or, you know, like hit making.
Another point is it is invisible, right? And I think why people feel frustrated about publishing is they're not often, I think what happens is people want really good feedback. Why did you say no to me? Why don't you love me? I put all my energy in this. You've just given me this totally polite, nondescript no. Fuck you. You know, I spent days, hours, months slaving away with this. And all I got was three letters, three sentences from you, right? Did you even read it? Nothing in your letter says that you read it, right? And now I've explained where we're coming from, right? Which is that I am not even going to commit. I cannot commit to everyone to give them that feedback. Cannot. Just physically can't. No one can. And actually, there is not a solution for that. Interestingly enough, there's not a tech solution for that, which is the detailed feedback. And I often find that on the occasions when I have given that detailed feedback to someone, when I can tell that they're happy more, I almost like, of course, they would have loved to have been published, but the fact that someone really spent time with their effort and gave them the respect of, like, you know, sort of acknowledging that effort. And but it is a very exhausting thing. I don't know. I mean, you see, I'm not sure. So what there is now, agents sort of do some of this work. But again, agents will run through the same problem. So what you'll find in publishers and agents is there'll be levels of no's. There'll be a bunch of no's that are totally like bland and non-committal. Then there'll be a couple of no's which will come with a lot of feedback. We almost loved you, but we didn't quite. But I feel like I can write you this, right? Recently, I read a thriller where I thought the premise was really good. It was about a woman intelligence officer, and she was posted in Bangladesh, and she's kind of very naive and idealistic, and she gets scapegoated by a very big, and basically they say that, like, she's been conspiring with militants in Bangladesh, and she gets expelled or whatever it is. And so it's kind of an interesting, it was India, Bangladesh, it was this woman protagonist, all that. But there were just, it didn't work for many reasons. One, the biggest reason it didn't work is that the premise was better than the working out of the book. So it's a thriller where it's not gripping enough.
Right.
The second half of the book where the actual action is meant to unravel, there isn't enough of it. There's a ton of problems with it. And I did write a slightly more detailed letter, like, then, oh, this is not for me, because I'd actually taken the trouble to read it. And the premise intrigued me enough to read it, you know, fully. And they said, you know, can you make this a better book? Can we work on it? And I said, I actually can't, because Jagannath's very small and I focus on nonfiction, and this is not something. And then I said, I will find a freelance editor for them. So I think that there are now sort of freelance editors and people who look at, and you know what, maybe that is the space. I mean, I you know what I'm even thinking as I talk to you, that there is a space there just for that person who's saying, I want to be read, I want to be heard, I want to be acknowledged. Okay, so getting a publisher, I need someone to hold my hand. I have all the right intentions to work hard, whatever, but I need someone to help me get there, right?
Who knows, one day Jagannath will have a writing incubator. You can also actually charge for feedback if you're declining books.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, actually, I think about it is that we just say, submit your novel here, pay X amount, and what we'll do
get detailed feedback, editing as a service, ES. Yeah. Lots of ways. Any happy to brainstorm anytime.
That's a great idea. As I talk to you, and I think I'm going to act on it.
Yeah, I have a plan ready. We can just like brainstorm at some point if you'd like. But this is a space where I can't tell you how many people on Network Capital, when they saw my book or they'll see my colleague Varya's book, hey, how to get published? Can you send it to a publisher? And we always like, you know, we do whatever we can, but there's a huge market opportunity. I think you can see that.
That is actually, so when you say, you know, is publishing democratic, I would say yes. And it's democratic across the board. It's even democratic socially, you know. But publishing isn't. If you are, one of the interesting things about the world of publishing is it's not very well paid, right?
Yeah.
So you have to sort of not be that. So it doesn't get that IIT top ranker type kid, right? It gets a very wide ranging person who's made the decision to be in it for one, they love books.
Right.
And then they often come from all over, you know. Your sales teams come from particular places, your marketing people come from particular places, but it's not like, you know, it's a very middle class professional world. It's not where the best of the, you know, it's not an industry that I would call especially like a very snobby.
It's not a talent magnet yet.
It isn't, and it's not a snobby industry. I mean, you know, like in America and UK, you would have said there was a tradition of sort of gentlemen going into publishing who had a bit of money and were very well educated, and they did it. And so there was a tradition of sort of gentlemen's publishers, and that's what, if you see the sort of history of publishing in those countries. But that's not the case now, and it's certainly not the case in India. I mean, it is not. And the other thing is that every editor will tell you this, and they mean it. Even they are looking for the next hit, and the hit, they want some new writers. So it's not that there isn't a mismatch. It is that there's a volume issue, there's a bandwidth issue, there's just, you know, a feedback issue, right? I mean, those are the kind of problems rather than, you know, anything else.
Just like, you know, we're coming towards the end of it. If you have a couple of more minutes, I'd like to ask you a few questions. In the many, many, many years you've done this job, now as an entrepreneur, but before as an editor-in-chief, have you found an evolution in how India reads? And do you have any like macro thesis on where India is heading when it comes to reading, content consumption through the written word?
Well, I think the big one is Indians want to read about India. They are, you know, so and Indians, and so Indian history, Indian botany, Indian kids books, of course, Indian mythology. Indians love, you know, but if, you know, why this is particular is if you were a British publisher or a Brazilian publisher or a Japanese publisher, you would buy books from all over the world. Oh, there's a great, I mean, like, Do Epic Shit has been sold in Russia. A Russian reader wants to read about this Indian influencer, right? Now, if you gave me a book by a Russian influencer, I'd say, I mean, I'll look at it. But unless, like, those that I can tell that lots of Indians are watching this Russian influencer, I won't buy it for this market. So what I mean is that, like, Indians are very, very insular in the book, in the subjects that they read, right? And I think that may have been the case earlier on, but this has become accentuated, you know. We like our hits. So that's one. Two is that the big change in my time has been that the world of nonfiction publishing has become wider, deeper, richer. So you have more works of history, you have young history, you know, you have more works on, as I said, things like Kings of Delhi or the history of prehistory of India's like landmass, you know, or you know, we now have started an imprint on Indian birds. I mean, it's as narrow as it gets, right?
Yeah.
So nonfiction across, and of course there's self-help, spirituality, cookery, I mean everything, but it's all Indian, and it's all these different bits of nonfiction That's become more developed, that's become more sophisticated, that's doing better, and that's where a lot, large part of your leadership is. The other thing that has stayed the same is I think that Indians, the books that they love are still, and the authors who become iconic write very simply. So when you think of the iconic Indian author, like Khushwant Singh, Sudha Murthy, a Ruskin Bond, why are they loved? They write very simply. And they write stories that are very desi, really. They're not like about some kid who grows up in Calcutta and then goes off to England to study and then comes back. No, it's like a even Chetan Bhagat, very simple writing. Really, really. There's a reason why, you know, young engineers from B towns were reading Chetan Bhagat because they could read him. You know, we forget we have so much. I mean, our school revolution has hardly. I know virtually every Indian child goes to school, but they're not, you know, if you read this Assar report, which is this annual survey, which is done by Pratham, you know, our levels of reading, our levels of maths across schools in India are really low. We're 3-4 grades below, you know, every grade is 3-4 grades below than what they should be. So I think that like that, I felt more strongly as I've, every year that the books that work best in India are often simply written. And I think the big trend in my time is the richness, depth, growth, diversification of various kinds of nonfiction books.
Yeah. Is there anything, Chiki, that I should have asked you that I didn't, or any parting words? I think this is the starting of a long-term collab. We'll keep brainstorming and hosting other juggernaut writers.
Lovely. No, I don't. This is a great conversation. I enjoyed every bit of it. I really hate having these conversations where you made me think about so many things I hadn't thought about, including giving me a great idea. So, you know, when as I tell you, it's like those dinner parties. If I come out of a conversation and I found one great idea, I think, it's been a very successful conversation. So thank you very much.
Very grateful for your time. I'll be in touch. Thank you.